scooter, I am free, and the world, it is my friend. Earbuds sing a sweet song while my scarf's a flapping in the wind. As I ride through these streets, inspiring all the drivers to give up their commutes and start living for the air.
What you just heard was the last YouTube stream of YouTube star Booty Booty, who attempted to film a live music video on a bird scooter, holding up traffic in New York City and eventually being murdered while streaming by a hit-and-run driver. Bird scooters, the controversial new transportation device appearing in our nation's cities, have a storied past and an infamous creator. I visited this creator, DeVille Good, in his palatial mansion in Malibu, and I think you'll find his reasons for creating the bird scooter to be surprising. I'm Colin Schuller, and you're listening to...
Much thanks to the boner alchemists over at BlueChew.com for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. That's blue, like the color blue. Blue Chew brings you the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis, so you know they work. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach, and since they're chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill, so you can be ready whenever an opportunity arises. I would not pitch this sort of thing to you if I hadn't tried it myself. And my friends, as a longtime consumer of a variety of pills of this nature, I can assure you it worked for me. And if it worked for me, it'll probably work for anybody. Blue Chew is prescribed online and shipped straight to your door in its discreet package. So no in-person doctor's visit, no waiting in the pharmacy, and best of all, no more awkwardness. But P.S., let me just add to that copy. Why are you awkward about it? If you're not getting boners and super fast, well, of course you're not. The ice caps are melting. Every time you turn on the news, it's Anderson Cooper talking about aliens. It isn't exactly boner weather, friends. Also, they're made in the USA, and since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they're cheaper than a pharmacy. Right now, we've got a special deal for our listeners. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment free when you use our special promo code Duncan. You just pay $5 shipping. Again, that's BlueChew.com, promo code Duncan to try it free. Blue Chew is the better, cheaper, faster choice, and we thank them for sponsoring the podcast.
We're back with... I took a Saturday drive up to Malibu to visit with DeVille Good. The Saudi Arabian immigrant is the creator of bird scooters, the pay-to-play transportation device all over American cities. Black flags with the bird scooter logo and Arabic lettering fluttered above his massive driveway. And DeVille Good's house was painted the same midnight black as his infamous inventions, the bird scooters. He greeted me at the door, and I went inside. He sat down in the parlor, and I asked him the question that was on everyone's mind. Mr. Good, do you feel a responsibility? All the people are getting hurt on your scooter.
Our jihad against the West continues.
Did you say jihad?
Yes, that is correct. Jihad.
Like terrorism?
We were planning a variety of secret terrorist attacks.
Oh my god.
Destroying the Washington Monument. Beheading the Statue of Liberty. Driving speedboats into whales.
Speedboat into a whale. What is that? What's that?
Have you ever seen a speedboat drive into a whale?
No.
Of course not. It's terrifying. And I'm a terrorist. It's what we do. But by the Creator's grace, we realized that, in fact, all we had to do is distribute scooters throughout the cities of America.
You wanna hurt people?
Yes. Simple. Brilliant. Americans will get on anything that has a credit card machine on it. They just are drawn to it like moths to a flame.
But isn't this illegal?
No. The terms of service clearly state that we are ISIS, and that these bird scooters were created by us to destroy American lives. We had several teams of attorneys look over, so we are completely not liable for any harm caused by these wonderful machines.
Holy shit. Okay, well, thanks for the interview. You're melting me. A beam came out of DeVille Gunn's eyes and melted me. And now I'm just in some kind of cup, all melted in a cage. This has been Colin Schuller.
Much thanks to Colin Schuller for that riveting bit of journalism. We have got a fantastic podcast for you today, pals. Mitch Horowitz is here to talk about his new book, Magician of the Beautiful, an introduction to Neville Goddard. I have been in a deep Neville Goddard rabbit hole for the last month or so, and it is completely transforming my life. He has a wild and I guess you could say controversial philosophy that involves the idea that the imagination is the paintbrush of God and that you are God. And it's some of the most psychedelic, incredible, beautiful, sometimes very complex, sometimes laughably ridiculous philosophy that I've ever heard. But since I've been working with some of his ideas, I've got to admit, I've experienced some pretty wild synchronicities, some of which you're going to hear during this interview. So stay tuned. We'll be back with Mitch Horowitz. If you've got the desire to snort glory off the buttocks of an ironclad sun god, then head over to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Patreon. And my children, we are about to take that Patreon and ignite it. It's about to go wild with a lot of new tiers and new stuff. Currently working on the relaunch, which is going to happen November 15th. But in the meantime, head over, sign up, check it out. There's a lot of extra stuff over there. You'll get commercial-free episodes of the DTFH, plus an extra hour-long rambling thing once a month. Subscribe. We also have a shop located at DuncanTrussell.com, and we are dropping 10 new designs in the shop in time for the Christmas season. So go to DuncanTrussell.com and click on the shop link. Okay, today's guest, wow. This is the second DTFH that I've done with him, and every single time I communicate with him, my life changes for the better. He is an author and a speaker, and he is an expert on someone who I am deeply absorbed in right now. Neville Goddard. He has written, I don't know, a billion books, but Mitch just wrote a fantastic introduction to him called Magician of the Beautiful. You should definitely check it out. Mitch has written a lot of great books. If you want to find out more about Mitch, go to his website, mitchhorowitz.com. All the links you need to find him are going to be at duncantrussell.com. So now, everyone, please, welcome back to the DTFH, Mitch Horowitz. Mitch, welcome back.
thank you, man. Wonderful to be here.
Great to see you. I'm going to dive right into it because whenever I get to spend time with someone like you, I want to take advantage of that time. Now, you introduced me to the subject of your latest book, Magician of the Beautiful, an intro to Neville Goddard, set in a secondhand way, because you introduced it to a friend of mine, Noah Lampert,
yes,
who then started telling me about it. And then I started listening to an audiobook by him, and my mind started melting because it was so brilliant. It was such an interesting interpretation of Christianity.
Yeah.
And also, and we discussed this before we started recording, there is so much strangeness in what he's saying that I'm confused by bits and pieces. But before we get into that confusion, I thought maybe you could give us a little a synopsis of who Neville Goddard is and what his philosophy is about in
sure.
a nutshell.
Yeah, Neville was a British Barbadian mystic who lived and worked here in the U.S. until his death in 1972. And he had one essential teaching, which is that your imagination is God. And he meant this in the most literal sense, that everything that you experience, everything that occurs in your life, is your own emotionalized thoughts and mental pictures pushed out into the world. And Neville taught that whenever you read a reference to Jesus or Yahweh in Scripture, Old Testament, New Testament, that is a symbolical reference to your own imagination, and that Scripture itself is nothing other than a blueprint to your own psychical development, which will culminate in your realization of yourself as the Creator clothed in human flesh. And the important thing to note is that he didn't mean this as metaphor. He meant this quite literally, that your imagination is what we in the Western world call God.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what are his roots in? Where did he get this from?
You know, he was born into this rural society in 1905 in Barbados to an Anglican family. He came to New York City to study theater at the age of 17 by himself, and he had some success in the theater world. He was in silent films. He performed on the Broadway stage. He traveled as part of a dance troupe in the United States and Europe. And he was experimenting with various mystical and occult ideas late 1920s, wasn't getting anywhere. And he said that in the early 1930s, he met this mysterious teacher, this turbaned black Jewish man named Abdullah, a Jewish man of Ethiopian descent, and that Abdullah tutored him in this mind metaphysics, as well as in scripture, Kabbalah, number symbolism, and that it was from Abdullah that he got his philosophy of mental creativity. And soon thereafter, he started publishing and writing. And the amazing thing about Neville is he delivered thousands of lectures across his lifetime, wrote more than 10 books. He was incredibly prolific, and he would restate this thesis over and over again that your imagination is God. And every time he spoke of it, every time he wrote of it, it seemed fresh and entirely new. And that's why people just fall into Neville, because when you start reading him, when you start listening to him, you're imbibing this radical idea, and every time you encounter it, it feels like the first time. He had that incredible capacity, which I think is seen very, very rarely. Sometimes you find this in Emerson, sometimes you find this in Krishnamurti, that every time the man said something, it sounded like you were hearing it in that radical new way, as if for the first time.
Wow. It is like that. It yeah. is like every time I listen to this audiobook, every time I sit down with it, it's an entire new illumination seems
yes.
to happen. Do you believe in Abdullah? Is that real? Or do you think he was saying that because he was worried people wouldn't just accept the fact that sometimes anybody can have these transmissions or
yeah.
these epiphanies?
That's a really tough question, and I've wrestled with it. And in Magician of the Beautiful and elsewhere, I write about the possible identity of Abdullah. I also write about the possibility that Abdullah was a composite. He may have been a collection of teachers that Neville wrote about. Now, the purists would say, I'm all wrong, that Abdullah should be taken at face value, that this was a really existing man. And it is true that Neville gave the address where Abdullah lived on the Upper West Side. I've visited it. I've been inside the building.
What?
I've tracked down all the historical reference points that are available to us. And I can't conclude one way or the other whether Abdullah was an absolutely real person or whether Abdullah was part of a kind of American metaphysical tradition, which you'll see in Carlos Castaneda, you'll see it in Madame H.P. Yes. Blavatsky, where people will create a mythos, not necessarily a falsehood, but a mythos around a mysterious teacher and talk about this person as their path of learning personified, in the same way that we'll talk about gods personified. You know, we'll identify a certain energy and say, that's Athena, that's Zeus, that's Minerva, that's Set. So it could be that, or it could be that the people who make a literal reading are absolutely correct, that Abdullah was a real flesh and blood man. Certainly they would argue that.
Well, okay, this is a different podcast we'll have to do, because right now I feel two possible directions forming. One of them is I want to talk to you about my feeling when I've been listening to it, which is like, oh, this is one of those mystery school transmissions where they decided that it's like, okay, illuminate the masses. They're ready for this information. And I keep thinking like, oh yeah, somebody's like letting him be the mouthpiece of a thing that is definitely people have been sort of not concealing it, but I don't know. I just get a sense of like, Abdullah makes sense to me just based on my hippie intuition.
Yes.
But that's a different conversation. The mystery schools and the people that come from them. I want to talk about the philosophy itself. But before we get into that, I want to talk about your personal connection to Neville, because it seems like he has been a huge influence on you, and clearly you're inspired by him because you wrote an entire book on him. You've written other books that cover New Thought, Ancient Wisdom.
Tradition. Oh yeah, and Neville's at the heart of many of them, and I have a tattoo of Neville on my left arm. You know, he's kind of he's the primary figure in my life. I first discovered him back in 2003. I was interviewing the MLB pitcher Barry Zito, who at the time was pitching for the San Francisco Giants, or maybe it was the Oakland A's. Barry pitched for both the A's and the Giants. And Barry identified Neville, among other sources, as a core part of his training regimen, core part of his life. He had been exposed to Neville by his parents. Cool. And in the conversation, he said, you must really be into this guy. And I had never heard the name. Because when Neville died in 72, and for many years after, he was a really underground figure. He didn't really fit within the New Thought tradition. He wasn't categorizable in any specific way. He couldn't be grouped with any school or thought system. He was completely original. And as such, people just didn't hear of him. And he was a mystery man. They didn't know, was he black? Was he white? Was he still living? Who is this Abdullah? And I immediately went out and got one of Neville's books called Resurrection, which he wrote in 1966. And I just fell into it. I went all the way down the rabbit hole. And part of the reason I grokked so deeply to Neville's thought system had something to do with him as a figure. I mentioned his writing and how elegant and simple and beautiful it is, but there's also hundreds of his lectures preserved online because he would permit people, Grateful Dead style, to freely tape record his lectures, which later became digitized. And the man speaks with such a beautiful, resonant, mellifluous voice. It's like nothing you've ever heard. He speaks extemporaneously, without notes. He can hold forth for 90 minutes in a lecture, citing scripture as if from out of the ether. And he just has this beautiful voice that you could call it soothing, but it's at the same time arousing and awakening. He looked like a movie star. The man just looked like a matinee idol, like a Cary Grant. And yet he very rarely permitted photos to be taken of him. There's just one or two professional photographs of Neville bopping around the internet, few other snapshots here and there. And it's so different from our time where everybody's documenting, you know, every third thing they do today. And Neville, he looked like a movie star. He spoke with this beautiful clipped mid-Atlantic accent. And yet there were very few instances where he sat for professional photos. He self-published his books. He allowed his lectures to be freely taped. He had no business apparatus behind him. How different is that from us today?
Yeah.
You know, every yoga teacher has this massive business apparatus at his or her back. And Neville was just a troubadour. He had none of that. So there was something about the man himself that bespoke sincerity to me. He seemed to be living out something that was intrinsic in his teachings. I very often enter people's ideas first through their persona. I my informal rule is show me the person first and the teaching second.
Yeah.
If I dig the person, then I want to know what's at the back of his or her life.
Right.
And I fell into his life, and I concurrently fell into his teaching. And I came to feel that there was in Neville this radical sense of mystical possibility, epic self-potential, a liberating sense of self-responsibility, not a narrow self-responsibility, but a deeply liberating and freeing sense of self-responsibility. And I think when people are facing stresses or difficulties in life, and they meet the teaching of this man who says, you truly have it in you at this very moment to revolutionize everything in your life through your own thoughts because you are God. It is so inviting. It's such a resplendent possibility
yeah.
that unless a person is completely closed off or completely materialist, it's hard to resist not experimenting.
And the experiments work, and they work fast, and they work so fast it makes your head spin sometimes.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there can also be a gestation period where you, as you get into Neville, you begin to identify things about your surroundings, about your relationships, about your career life, about your emotional life, that also seem to have antecedents from earlier parts of your life so vividly that it can be jarring. I mean, I'm living out experiences today at the age of 53 that so closely comport to things that I was thinking about from my earliest childhood, literally going back to age 3, age 4, that it's uncanny. So there can also be this gestation period, and suddenly your life seems to have symmetry for the first time.
Well, this brings me to just where I wanted to land, because I knew, you know, I would go to Agape Church and listen to Beckwith, who's inspired by these many of these teachers. And
yeah.
But I never heard in this particular pool of wisdom this idea of revising your past.
Yes, yes.
Now, this is what made my brain pop, because he does, at least in this book, just very casually, he starts talking about the fifth dimension.
Yes.
He starts talking about, I guess, this concept that we're sort of in a frame of time, but the past is continuing at this very moment. It's a living past.
Yes.
And the formation of the past, as it is living now, is shaping your present.
Right.
And nobody that I know,
that's right,
thinks that they can change the past.
Right. The closest analog that you find to that way of thought actually comes from some of the classical quantum physicists, including Erwin Schrödinger and Hugh Everett, who theorized the many worlds thesis. These men in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, way before quantum physics became popularized, way before its language had entered the zeitgeist, they were writing something concurrent to Neville that was very close to his philosophy. Schrödinger theorized that if you were, in his great Schrödinger's cat experiment, if you could extrapolate what we're seeing in the particle world into our physical world, into our everyday above ground macro world, you would be not only selecting the localization of particles, but you would be selecting a past for those same particles. The decision to look or the decision not to look actually creates a multidimensional effect. It's not as simple as saying, well, gee, this thing existed in potential and now it exists in fact because I looked. Yes, that much is true. So we're determining from experiments in the particle lab, 80 years of experiments. But it's also true that you'd be creating a past for the particle based on when you choose to look, if you choose not to look, if you look after lunch or before lunch. So if you think about it, you are recreating existence every time you experience a shift in perspective, a preconception, an emotionalized thought, every time you make a decision. Every perception in and of itself brings with itself a whole dimension of experience. The particle theorists were writing about this from the perspective of quantum mechanics. Neville was writing about this from the perspective of his own mystical experience. He and they were saying essentially the same thing without knowing one another, without ever being in the same room with one another, without reading one another. And Neville created the greatest mystical analog that we have to quantum physics. And as you were saying, Neville would point out that every time you are engaging in an act of mental creation, you are not only selecting present and future circumstances, but by the very dint of what you're doing, you're selecting past circumstances as well. And you can not only revise your past, but we're doing it all the time. We're doing it all the time. We don't sense it because we walk around thinking, well, gee, I just walked from point A to point B. I get it. I have a memory of being at point A. It's perfectly symmetrical. It's perfectly rational. But Neville would say, is it? Is it? Because your so-called memory of point A is based on where you are at point B right now. There are infinite possibilities. Reality is in a state of superposition in the sense of in the infinitude as it exists. There are endless pasts, just as there are endless futures, just as there are endless presents. So your memory of point A, in a sense, is just a construct. Mm-hmm. And you're invited to revise it if you wish. Yeah.
But the implication of this is so wild in the sense that right now, our experience theoretically could be us in some future reality revising our past.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I would even say this. I would say to your listeners, Mitch and Duncan are not even here. You, the listener, you're here. You're here. You're listening to Mitch and Duncan, but we are just projections of your own thought system. It may just be that you were intellectually prepared to arrive at this material at this particular moment in your existence. And so, in effect, you've created Mitch and Duncan, who seem vivid, who seem real.
Yeah.
And we are just a construct emanating from your own thoughts, bringing you to this information, but it's yours. You're the creator.
Mitch, actually, if you could see him right now, is an eagle, and I'm a little snake.
So dig that. Thank you for creating us. Thank you for selecting us. And, you know, I often tell people in New Thought settings, people use the word manifest all the time. That's not quite my term. The term I use is select, because I think that's more vivid. We are selecting. If everything is in existence, if reality is in infinitude, which William Blake told us, which Erwin Schrödinger told us, which so many other great mystics and scientists through history have told us, if reality is in infinitude, it's not so much that the individual is manifesting so much as selecting. And the tools for selection, the tools for selection are our own emotionalized thoughts and mental pictures. What are those but tools of measurement?
Holy shit. It is. But it's, and again, the app for me, I wouldn't even be talking about this if I hadn't been vigorously applying it over the last month or so and seeing results that are beyond astounding. And one of the things I like about Neville is that he gives examples like real.
Oh, yes.
And I'm going to give a real quick one. And I was wondering if you could give one as well.
Sure.
So, as I've been listening to this, basically one of his, I don't remember which book it is, but I'm listening to this audiobook compilation. I can't wait to read your breakdown of it. But the so what I'm reading right now is, you know, talking about wishing harm or good on someone else. And,
yes.
And one of the things he says is if you give someone the gift of wishing a thing upon them.
Yes.
And they don't accept it.
Yes.
Then the gift will be returned to you.
Yes. He has a reciprocity in his teaching. You know, yeah. People always say, gee, the problem with all this New Thought stuff is that it's an ethical free-for-all. Who am I to be wishing stuff into somebody else's life? Or what happens when a bad guy gets hold of this? And I honor that concern, although I would also say the materialists need to have that concern too. We're making ethical decisions all the time. This just broadens the sense of playing field. But Neville has a teaching of cosmic reciprocity, so to speak, in which if I wish something for you, Duncan, and it's something that Duncan is incapable of wishing for another, in other words, if it's something generous, but Duncan doesn't wish things that are generous, or if it's something negative, and Duncan doesn't want to wish things that are negative for another, it comes back to me, the sender, for good or ill. So yeah. we gotta deal with the whole of life. These teachings are not just an ethical free-for-all.
And his invitation is this: you need to become a really focused gardener of the ecosystem of your thoughts, because
exactly.
If you're wishing ill, even in the most subtle way, upon a person who doesn't accept that, who sees themselves as not someone who's an asshole like you think they are, that asshole projection goes bouncing right back into you, and then it can, you know, make you go around limping, which is why a lot of times when you meet people who gossip, they're not doing very well.
Boom. You know, dude, you just affirmed my belief in one universal mind, because I thought to myself literally that instant, I got to make a point about gossip. Nothing is more deteriorative of the human condition than gossip. It's horrible. Anything that we say in the negative about another individual, and it doesn't mean not calling out injustice. It doesn't mean abstaining from saying, hey, there's something wrong here that needs to be fixed. But that kind of gossip that's nothing but trash talk, that kind of gossip that's nothing but a smear for entertainment value or what have you, that deteriorates our lives immeasurably, because we are engaging in an act of reciprocity. Those effects become, in a sense, it's self-description. And I always tell people that the number one thing you can do to improve your life this instant is to desist from gossip. And if you practice that for 1 hour, you will stand more erect. You will feel more noble. Yeah. You will feel more at ease. Everybody's always out there in the world saying, what can I do? What can I do? Give me something to hang on to. Hang on to this. Desist from gossip and rumor for 60 minutes. See what happens to you.
And if you do find yourself gossiping, look at the way you feel. It's the grossest feeling.
It's the worst. I used to go to lunch with somebody, and I would always have these mixed feelings about it, because she was a friend, but I would always get lured into this long, gossipy meal that would go on for 2.5 hours, and I'd feel physically sick at the end of it. Yeah. I'd feel drained. I'd feel sick. That was not imaginary.
This episode of the DTFH has been supported by CryoFreeze. Friends, I read David Goggins sometime in early October or late September, and since then, I don't know what happened, but I've been getting up at 4 or 5 a.m. and working out. But I'm in a 45-year-old's body that hasn't consistently exercised in approximately 4 years, so I get the type of soreness you might expect from a recently thawed-out woolly mammoth that's been forced into doing tricks in an alien circus on a distant planet with more gravity than here on Earth. That is some serious fucking soreness, but my agonized trembling muscles gave me the perfect opportunity to try out today's sponsor, Cryo Freeze. If you're looking to get rid of nagging muscle and joint pain immediately while providing long-lasting recovery, then you need to try the natural breakthrough pain relief solution, Cryo Freeze CBD, developed by Omax Health. It's a combination of CBD and menthol, and it works. It's 100% natural. And within 15 minutes of application, you get relief that lasts up to 8 hours. I tested this claim. It was like a frozen angel breathed on my biceps and the pain evaporated within 15 minutes. It really works. The frozen angels over at Omax Health are offering my listeners 20% off a full bottle of CryoFreeze Pain Relief Roll-On plus free shipping. This discount also applies towards any product site-wide. Just go to omaxhealth.com today and enter code Duncan to take advantage of this incredible savings. That's omaxhealth.com. Enter code Duncan to get 20% off CryoFreeze site-wide. This stuff is Jesus. It's bottled ice Jesus. Don't let muscle soreness continue to be an excuse for not living an active lifestyle. Go to omaxhealth.com and feel relief faster. Again, that is omaxhealth.com. OMAXHealth.com. Enter code Duncan to get 20% off CryoFreeze and all site-wide items. Now, this within this sort of wishing well for other people, and then especially wishing well for your, you know, people who you might have some like disconnect from or some weirdness with or whatever. Yeah. Because he would say, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that weirdness you're experiencing from them, you're creating the weirdness.
He would say that, yeah.
So I started, you know, working with somebody that I've felt like, I guess I've considered like, I don't know, that person, I don't think they really like me, or there's some weird shit there. And then I just started imagining that person really liking me and us being friends and things being cool. And sure as shit, I saw him the next day. We never talk. He came walking up to me, gave me some really nice compliments, was really kind to me.
Yeah.
And I tried not to like stammer in amazement because it was like the day before I'd been doing this exercise.
Right, right.
I mean, we're talking years maybe go
right,
by
right, right.
That I don't talk to this person.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
I do. And Neville would always say that if you have friction in the world, leave the world alone. Leave the other person alone and just look in the mirror. Just keep coming back to the mirror. Don't try to change the other. The world is nothing but myself pushed out. Look in the mirror. And again, there's something so liberating about it, because instead of changing Mike or trying to persuade Mike of my point of view, I can withdraw into the recesses of my own psyche and work out whatever needs working out.
It is.
And that's the teaching.
It's so crazy. And then just the strange relief that I've been going back and spending time with like people who I've hurt and in those moments, living out those moments as though I wasn't selfish, wasn't angry.
Yeah.
You know, talking to my mom before she passed in a way that I wasn't, you know, lost in fear of her dying.
Yes.
And it does produce almost instantaneous, I'm not saying external change, but a sense of,
yes.
I think I've, that's how you forgive yourself.
Yes.
You don't forgive yourself by being like, okay, I forgive me now.
Right.
You go back and revise.
You go back and revise. And Neville would also say to people that there are sometimes these gestation periods. Sometimes there's a time interval. And he had an expression, an assumption, though false, if persisted in, will concretize into fact. An assumption, though false, if persisted in, will concretize into fact. And he would say, look, we see in the natural world, a chick takes 30 days to hatch. A baby, a human baby, 9 months. A horse, 11 months. A goat, 6 months. So sometimes there will be a time interval. And he would say, you know, just let that be. Let that be. If you wish to be in Paris and you wake up and you find you're still in your old circumstances, that may feel disappointing and that is understandable. But just stay with it, because this gestation period sometimes just has to be abided.
Oh, wow, man. Only just because, like, another of the things I've been visualizing is taking my wife to Paris.
No way. How wonderful. Wow. We're getting
crazy,
it all done.
Man.
Yeah.
Now, can you tell me an example of working with this philosophy?
Oh, sure. I find that for me personally, sometimes the results seem fairly instant, and sometimes, as I was referencing, there are these gestation periods. I had an instance recently where I sat for a shoot with a certain photographer, a really, really great photographer who a friend had hooked me up with. And the photographer showed me one of the contact sheets from what he was working on. And the pictures were exactly something, the very scene that I had imagined myself being in when I was 20 years old. I remember it as vividly as, you know, the fingers on my hand. And I have a lot of instances like that in life where sometimes time will pass and I determine this unbelievable symmetry. I want to share something intimate with you and your listeners. And this is heavy because it's disclosing of something personal, but at the same time, it's important to be blunt. When I was a little kid, I mentioned memories going back to my earliest years of forming cognizant long-term memories. So say when I was very, very young, even 4 years old, 5 years old, I might be playing a game with the kids in my neighborhood, like boys play war games and things like that. War is fun, right? So sure. We all like to play that game. And while my friends and I were engaged in this war game, silently, without telling them, without disclosing them, I was playing along and doing all the stuff everybody else was doing. But I was imagining myself actually as an actor in a movie, in a war movie with the camera on me. And I would even imagine that the sandbox and things like that that we were playing in was like a movie set. And that was my earliest wish at that age. For whatever reason, that's what I did. That was my fantasy life. And it took years and years and years, but I am at midlife today, so-called, living out on camera, in front of microphones, in front of audiences, all the things that I was imagining when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
I was never playing the game. I was playing an actor in the game. Neville was an actor himself, and he said, we're all thespians. We're all actors. Mm. And I'm living that out in my life today after many, many twists and turns. And I find myself living exactly the life that occupied my earliest memories and fantasies. And I get chills sometimes over it.
It is like that because, you know, we're sort of, where this goes to me is, I get, the other day as I'm listening to this, I had this thought, like, oh my God, it's not that they're going to invent a time machine. It's that we are the time machine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Time travel, understood from this perspective, is a mental act, and we're engaging in it all the time. Mm-hmm. In fact, when we have those little fantasies, we like to play these therapeutic games with ourselves. What would I say to my younger self if I could travel back and give counsel to myself at age 12, age 13? Seen from this perspective, we're doing that constantly. So be careful, because we're doing that constantly. If linear time is an illusion, and I think we can say that at this point in the 21st century, you know, linearity is a very necessary illusion for five sensory beings. We know that time bends, so to speak, at light speed. We know that time bends in circumstances of extreme gravity.
Right.
Everyone accepts that. The implications of that are a different story. We accept the data, we don't accept the implications. If time is an illusion, if linearity is a necessary illusion, then everything is going on at once, and our sensory organs are nothing other than tools of measurement, just like the tools used in the quantum lab. So to say, I'm going to go back and give advice to my younger self, that's literally real. It would have to be. It follows that it would have to be.
Wow. It's so wild, because what we're looking at here is the time machine learning how to operate itself. And so we're seeing a kind of, if you were building a time machine, somewhere along the course of the things forming, and maybe the time machine would be like the improbability drive in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah.
Improbable that it would come into existence, that it came into existence.
Yes. Because
that's what it does. But
yes,
in this case, it would almost be working its way. Well, even though we're saying time is one thing, from our perspective, it's growing from the future back into the past.
Exactly.
It's so weird. And that means that we're at the point where it's just gaining enough sentience to begin to dial in, to not just measure, but to dial in coordinates, so to speak.
Which exactly. Is what these... Beautifully put. And like, if I were to say to your listeners, everybody out there who's listening right now, I want you to please think of the time when you first learned to ride a bicycle. Just hold a mental picture of when you first learned to ride a bicycle. When you first felt that you were riding without the training wheels, you felt the handlebars, boom. Everybody has a mental picture of that. And everybody is certain, yep, that's precisely what happened. Is it? You may have created that right now at this instant, as vivid and as real as the chairs we're seated on.
So again, man, I love being around, I like being around people who do this kind of work.
I do too.
Because
me too.
It's always, again, I don't mean to keep doing, I think it was day before yesterday, I was just thinking about my dad teaching me how to ride my bike.
Yeah, so it's
again,
crazy,
it's
right?
Funny, yeah, it's funny. This the all of, it's just really curious. But
yeah, may I share a very quick story just about how time gets all mixed up and everything? Very, very quick. Okay, I'm really interested in the band The Monkees. I have all these crazy, crazy synchronicities with The Monkees. Just the other day, I was in Kansas City. I ran into Mickey Dolenz from The Monkees,
cool,
who was totally chill and nice and lovely. And about 2 years ago, just out of the fucking blue, I start getting into the music of The Monkees. And everybody around me is like, fuck is wrong with you? Like, why are you so into The Monkees? And I'm like going full throttle on The Monkees. I'm reading biographies, doing this, doing that. And okay, this was in the summer. Come October, I get this call from an editor at the Washington Post. And he said, we have been trying to find you. And I'm like, why am I so hard to find? And he said, your email's not working. Something's going wrong. Anyway, he said, do you know Michael Nesmith from The Monkees? And I said, well, I know of him, of course. And he said, do you know Mike Nesmith has been, over the course of his life, a Christian Scientist? And I said, no, I didn't know that. And he said, do you know him personally? And I said, no. And he said, do you know he just wrote a memoir? No. Would you like to review it? And I was like, well, you know, fuck yes. Nesmith writes this memoir called Infinite Tuesday, which is really brilliant and wonderful, about among other things, about time loops, about the non-existence of linearity. And all of this came to me in this kind of seemingly backwards way, where I had cultivated this crazy interest in the monkeys. And then months later, the editor comes to me and invites me to review Nesmith's memoir, Infinite Tuesday, which is a great book. And I was already so prepped, so prepared, so ready to go. I was almost embarrassed to tell my editors over the post. I wrote the review in 24 hours because it was like a whole universe of prep had already come to me months prior. And I put all this in the review, and to their credit, they kept it in the review. You don't find like a lot of psychedelic philosophy necessarily in the book review section of the post, but there it was. And, you know, so it was a case in which there was such symmetry and there was such a sense of time just being in this state of what he calls Infinite Tuesday. Not a past, present, and future, but one great superposition whole. Just one story I wanted to share.
Whoa. Yeah. It's, you know, again, there's a lot of places my mind wants to go, but I do want to sort of ground it in some questions I did have for
Please.
You.
Please.
Okay, so I'm simultaneously listening to In Love with the World by Mingyur Rinpoche, which mm-hmm. It's a great book. He's a tulku who snuck out of his monastery and went and lived the life of a beggar for, I think, 3 or 5 years as his next retreat or whatever. It's really good. But because my main, at least for the last year, my main focus has been like some Vajrayana Buddhism, some Chogyam Trungpa. I've been trying to bridge these two philosophies, Buddhism and whatever you would call this.
Yeah.
And I've run into I don't want to say a problem with Buddhism, because that is so audacious, and obviously that's my problem, not Buddhism's problem, but maybe you could help me with this particular place I feel stuck.
Yeah, yeah.
Goddard's philosophy, which I love, is liberating and also self-directed.
Yes.
Whereas it feels like in Buddhism and some other philosophies, even some like Meister Eckhart Christian mysticism, we find a place of thy will be done.
Yes.
A disconnect from the self and a kind of just let this be as it is and learn to accept it as it is. Don't worry about forming your desires into time and space, because that's just going to cause more suffering anyway. Don't get in the way of the pen of the divine as it writes your life on the page of time. Don't fuck it up, man. It's doing, it's perfect as it is. But what I love about Goddard is he isn't saying that. He's like, no, you are writing the book.
Write
what you want. So can you make these two things work, or are they is my analysis correct? Is that what's going on?
I think your analysis is correct, and I've been in that particular place myself. There were times actually where I felt torn in two by my dedication to Neville and my dedication to a philosophy that might be enunciated as thy will be done. Because Neville's philosophy, and this can push some people's buttons, is really my will be done. Yeah. Neville would say that your desires are sacred. Your desires are prophecy. Your desires should never be neglected, because they are the voice of God itself. That voice being your own human imagination. Neville would say there is no God other than your own wonderful human imagination. And his system does have an ethical reciprocity, a cosmic reciprocity. So it's not as if it just gives the individual carte blanche to do unto others, because whatever you're doing unto others, by definition, in his philosophy, you're doing unto self. But he would say that your desires are the voice of God speaking to you, and that these things are not to be resisted. He would also say that desire satisfaction is only one element of his philosophy. The whole point of all this mental causation is to eventually become acquainted with yourself. Because as you discover the creative capacities of your mind, that's a necessary doorway through which you begin to discover your own true identity, your own sacred identity. And that as you pass through this world of Caesar and you experience all kinds of things and maybe get all kinds of goodies or what have you, eventually, those things are just detritus. Those things are only necessary stepping stones to realizing the nature of your own true self, which is God or Christ clothed in human flesh, as he would put it.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, is the scary part. I got to admit it. This is where it gets scary. And in this type of Buddhism, there's dream yoga. Mm-hmm. You've heard of this, the concept of dream yoga?
I haven't. Tell me, please.
Oh, shit. I'm going to give you this book.
Please.
It's called The Tibetan Yoga of Sleep and Dreaming and Sleep.
Uh-huh.
And so this is a practice that is similar to some of the teachings of God. What's the Western astral projection guy? Journeys Out of the Body. You wrote Journeys Out of the Body. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I know it. I can't summon it.
I'll put in the link, friends, if you can find it. It's a great book if you want to learn how to lucid dream. But within the techniques of lucid dreaming, a lot of us have heard, you know, set your timer every mm-hmm. 10 minutes and then look around and ask yourself if you're in a dream.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you're dreaming, you've conditioned yourself and you're going to look around in the dream and be like, oh, fuck, I'm dreaming. And then within that space, you can fly, you can walk through walls, mm-hmm. you can do mm-hmm. true miracles in a dream state.
Mm-hmm.
The difference in the Tibetan yoga of dreaming and sleep is it says, begin to recognize that you're in a dream right now.
Mm.
And it's not an intellectual exercise.
Yeah.
It's, no, this is a dream.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
you begin to, as part of this yoga, and it's so, the author of this book is so emphatic about this, that he has to leave a note at the end of the chapter about that, which is like, don't jump off a building.
Wow.
Don't go nuts.
Yeah.
It's that level of like, you are in a dream right now.
Fascinating.
And then when you do that, you'll notice focus happens. You don't get daydreamy. You get really in the moment.
Yes.
And things get very clear. So
yes.
This, the reason that there's, to me, something that's a little terrifying about what Neville Goddard is talking about is that gestation period that you're talking about seems to be more of a self-imposed gestation period.
Yeah.
Because we aren't ready yet for the big reveal.
Yes.
The big lifting of the veil, right?
Boom.
That's it.
Boom. Beautifully put. And I would add an exercise of Neville's that relates to lucid dreaming. I might call it cognizant dreaming. Neville's method prescribes entering into a state of mental creativity just in those few moments before you drift off to sleep at night.
Yes.
This is what sleep researchers call the hypnagogic state. And it's a very special, supple state of mind because when you're hovering between wakefulness and sleep, you're in a kind of dreamlike hallucinatory state. Reality seems to morph and bend. You can hear noises, but you're still cognizant. You still have some control over your attention. And as Neville put it, that is prime time for mental creativity. And that if you can induce yourself into that drowsy state in between sleep and wakefulness, we all enter it naturally twice a day, actually, just as we're falling asleep at night and just as we're coming to in the morning. Neville would do it through a nap he would take at 3 p.m. each afternoon. When you're in that so-called hypnagogic state, that is the state of real mental fertility. And sleep researchers, as well as serious psychical researchers, have identified that as prime time for self-suggestion, for the occurrence of ESP-related activities. Neville just had this natural instinct that that was a time in which the mind was uniquely supple. The great French mind theorist Emile Coué made this point as well. And I think Emile Coué was a great influence on Neville in his written work. So you can just go into this naturally meditative, drowsy state. You do twice a day anyway, and you can direct your attention within this dreamlike world, but you still have cognizant control. It relates sort of to lucid dreaming.
Yes.
And Neville felt that is the greatest platform that we possess, the greatest time of being, time of day that we possess for engaging in mental creativity. He would say, use that time to picture yourself in a certain scene that you want to be in. Don't see the scene as if it's up on a movie screen, but see yourself in it. Like maybe someone shaking your hand and congratulating you. Or maybe if you want to be married, feeling a wedding ring on your finger or saying I do at the altar. Feel yourself in the scene, repeat it as many times as it feels natural, and then drift off to sleep. And he said that is the great tool. It's not the only tool, but the greatest tool that we possess for mental creativity.
And he really means feel yourself in that place.
Yes.
It's not an intellectual thing. It's
right.
You have to be, like, literally be there. You have
yes.
to jump into that place.
Yes.
And to me, what within his philosophy, and it does coincide with my rudimentary explorations of quantum physics, is the implication that there is a way to evade death, that ascension is possible, mm-hmm. that you could theoretically drop your entire dream life
right.
and open your eyes and be in whatever the alchemical laboratory of the divine that we're currently apparently yes. inebriated on fumes from a beaker with it blew in our face or whatever it is.
Yes.
You could theoretically, before you could just wake up.
And this is the most controversial area of Neville's teachings, and it's one that I've sat with for a long time as a student, including as a critical student. Because, look, if one accepts this mystical quantum model that all of reality is in a state of superposition, then you'd have to argue that birth, death, everything, every passage of life is in superposition, and that death is just an experience. Death is just a perception. And that sounds very high and mighty of me seated in front of a microphone to say, you know, death is just a perception. But, you know, this is where I stop. And I say, you know, to my friends within the New Age culture, my friends within the New Thought culture, go visit a children's cancer ward before you start expounding on this idea of death being just a perception. Be very, very careful with that, because I would also contend that we experience many laws and forces, and we experience them with such vividness and such absolute tactile reality that I think we fail sometimes to underestimate when we start to get, you know, very exuberant about some of these things, the position of great disadvantage that we as five sensory beings can find ourselves in. If I were to stub my toe on a table right now, I would feel pain. My right. body undergoes changes. We all experience physical decline. We all experience death. We all, any sensitive person, has witnessed death in an atmosphere of great support and love and sensitivity. I don't believe, and I say this as someone who loves Neville, and I say this as a lifelong student of Neville, I don't believe Neville gave sufficient weight to the disadvantage that we men and women mm-hmm. have to always engaging in this world of mental creation, mental causation. We experience tremendous barriers, and we experience laws and forces that can be overwhelming. And proper gravity must be given to that fact. Proper gravity yeah. must be given to that fact. It's all well and good that I can talk about death as just a perception, but how dare I talk about that? How dare I talk about that on a cancer ward or someplace where a life has been snuffed out, even in an atmosphere of support and sensitivity and love? We live under many, or I shall say, we experience many laws and forces. And if a person doesn't bow to that, I think they are leaving out an enormous part of life that has to be contended with.
I want to play devil's advocate. I hate that term. I want to play somebody's advocate here.
Somebody's advocate.
I don't know whose, but you know, when I've been around dying people, and I'm lucky because I have been around people who've had good deaths, something really beautiful seems to be happening. Now, mm-hmm. I have not, mm-hmm. now, children's ward of a hospital.
Yeah.
I mean, we both have kids. I can barely think about
I
that, right?
I can barely think of it, yeah.
It's unbearable. Yeah. Unbearable, yeah. Unbearable.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you're in that moment,
yeah,
and it does kind of seem like to you, you're seeing a thing die.
Yeah, yeah.
But to this thing, it's just putting the body down, or, and this is, again, I know this, by the way, guys, I don't think I'm going to live forever. Anyone's going to live forever.
Right.
I haven't snapped.
Right.
But to get into the quantum physics thing that I read, which is, you are going to know more about, they were talking about quantum computers, and they were saying that actually, you know, the implication in some of this stuff is you really don't die. Your consciousness leaps over into some parallel universe, the mm-hmm. onion skin, mm-hmm. and you just keep going mm-hmm. in whatever thing it pops over to.
Mm-hmm.
And this does seem to really fit well with the Tibetan Buddhist, the Bardo thought all,
yeah.
the concept
yeah.
of in the Bardo state.
Yeah.
There is a potential to direct your liminal, astral, whatever the hell that momentum is that's mm-hmm. floating through there into your next birth, into something that is special to that state versus human existence.
Right, so, right, right.
To me, I think it could be that there isn't a chance here. Even in the children's ward of the hospital, what you're witnessing, and again, I'm just going to... This is from, if we're going to go full,
please,
just snorting full lines of pure Goddard.
Absolutely.
In that children's hospital,
yeah,
you're looking at the part of the multiverse you're hanging out in right now.
Yes,
that's
yes.
what you're seeing. You're seeing that place.
Right.
But you theoretically could upshift that to being not a hospital anymore, to being some kind of
yeah.
futuristic healing place. And then you could upshift that one more time to a convergence of souls and upshift that one more time until finally you're back in that pure unitive consciousness state where the entirety of all of this is like snow in a snow globe, so
yes,
to speak.
Absolutely. And I think that's well put. I would add a couple of things to that. People could be asking right now, well, gee, is Neville saying that there's no one else here? There's no one else present? There's just me, just my consciousness? He did teach that there are other people here, but we crisscross through one another's dreams of life in this way that summons or enlists us and vice versa in infinite directions whenever the individual's dream of life so requires. So he would say that Mitch passes through Duncan's life in this crisscrossing way, in this infinite superposition universe that we live in. Mitch has his own existence. Mitch has his own dream of life. Mitch has his own feelings. But Mitch will crisscross into Duncan's existence, into the experience of Duncan's listeners at given moments in life. We're all God. We're all clothed in human flesh. We all possess this creative capacity, but there's a multitudinous expression to this intelligence. So in a certain sense, yes, when I'm in this children's ward, this is where I am. This individual is just crisscrossing through my life at this given moment. I have ultimate power. He has ultimate power. And then this teaching gets into the most delicate territory when yes. questions of death and suffering are involved, because sometimes Neville would make reference, and other people loosely in his tradition, like Joseph Murphy, who said he shared Neville's teacher, Abdullah. Murphy wow. talked about this in an interview with a French journalist toward the end of his life, of all things. Neville would make reference on occasion, Murphy would make reference on occasion to everybody leaving life at just the chosen time, just the right time. And I push back against that. I push back against that because I haven't verified it. And when I speak of self-verification, and one hears this sometimes in a hypocritical way on the spiritual path, you know, people tell you, verify for yourself. And then in essence, what they're really saying is, when you've come to the same conclusion I have, then come back, you know.
That's great.
But until you do, I'll argue with you and say you don't get it. You know, if we're going to talk in terms of self-verification,
yeah.
we have to be absolute with that.
Yep.
My experience has been there are people who undergo death and suffering and illness, and that is not self-selected.
Okay.
And that throws us back on the heels of some very heavy questions about the laws and forces that we live under or that we experience. And this is not to be trifled with. You know, one could say, for example, that the force of gravity is ever operative. It's a universal law. But you're going to experience gravity differently here on Earth than you will on the moon or on Jupiter.
Right.
And in space, you'll experience its vacuum, even though it's still there and it's still operative. Gravity is affected by mass. In a certain sense, gravity is really mass being attracted to itself. It could be that with this law of mental causation, we are affected circumstantially. It could be there are different circumstances that interrupt, temper, color, condition, our experience of mental causation. Because I have not been able to verify this ultimate self-selected nature of life to the point where the child, him or herself, who's diseased or who doesn't have clean drinking water, is exiting life under chosen circumstances or under circumstances that are somehow cosmically symmetrical. I don't believe that because I haven't experienced that. And I ask people to respect this principle of self-verification to the extent that we not talk about experiences we haven't had. I haven't been through war. I haven't been through 9/11.
Yeah.
I haven't been through these human catastrophes. I want to hear from people who have, and I bow to them. But it's not my place to talk about that.
I love your critique of it. And honestly, as I'm sitting here thinking, like, God damn it, why did I have to get in the whole implications of this being eternal life and ascension, when it's, for me, way more pragmatic to talk about what's happening now, which hopefully we aren't in a place where we need to worry about ascending. Right. So this brings me to, well, something I wanted to say earlier, which is, like, you were saying you're in your 50s.
Yeah.
You look great.
Thank you.
You're vibrant.
Thank you.
You're healthy. You clearly are, like, taking really good care of yourself. You have some kind of exercise regimen?
You know, it's crazy, man. I mean, I thank you for saying all that. I don't take as good a care of myself as you might think. I drink. I smoke.
I smoke.
I do recreational drugs.
I definitely do that.
I don't sleep. You know, I eat steak frites, and so I feel very blessed, and I feel very fortunate, and I feel very grateful, you know, to you for saying that, but it's not as if I am some sort of fitness vulture. I mean, I do take care of myself in the sense that I do exercise, I do bicycle and all that jazz, but it's the craziest thing, Duncan. I have experienced this sense of youthful exuberance in my 50s. I feel better. I look better. I enjoy life more than I did in my 20s. It's crazy. Say of it what you will.
You're definitely not a vulture. You're an eagle. You're a fitness eagle. Right. So that's an interesting point. But for me, what I've been, as part of this experiment, I have been getting up at 4 a.m. every morning.
Wow.
And going to exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing it consistently. Well, you know, within reason, when there's like... you know, when I'm exhausted, you can really fuck yourself up by not getting enough sleep. But
that is true.
But for me, this has been equivalent to levitation. In other words, the gravitational hold of my subjective limitations is keeping me trapped inside a specific type of body.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so the practice, this Goddard stuff has, aside from like the weird coincidences, has resulted in like a consistent workout for the last month, more than I have ever been consistent my entire life.
Right, right.
And so to me, that is the ascension, and that is the as above, so below. So
right.
We cannot, in the same way that like we can't talk about what it's like to be on Saturn, for example.
Right, right.
But we can use our understanding of physics here and our, you know, now our telescopic ability, but let's say black holes colliding. Well, hopefully we're never going to experience that. If we do, we're gone.
Right.
But we can still use what our understanding of physics here on the Earth, where we are in the galaxy, in the universe, to understand what that would look like, even what it might feel like, even what it might sound like and smell like.
Yeah.
So similarly to me, it's like, fuck, if I can literally recode my behavior patterns by starting in my mind, connecting to a version of me that's healthier than I am right now, becoming that person. I was doing this at the gym when I first started it, looking at myself and having that first thing where I'm like, fuck, man, damn it, you really let yourself go. And then replacing that with seeing through myself in that form into my completely healthy form.
Yeah.
And now I'm watching my body start changing into that.
Right.
And it is astounding.
Right.
Because nothing else has really worked like that before.
Right.
So if that can happen with the physical body.
Yeah.
In the sense your thoughts can literally change your body vessel.
Absolutely.
Then the implication is just crazy.
We're
talking true levitation. We're talking walking through walls. I'm doing it again. I'm sorry, Mitch.
No, it's cool.
All the shit you hear about gurus doing, translocation and all that stuff.
You know, I would say this. Never neglect the means, the channels of arrival for whatever it is that you're interested in. You know, some people could say, well, gee, Duncan, of course you look great because you've been working out. That's simple, right? We get it. Well, it's not so simple because there are always going to be different means and different channels of arrival. I have wished for things, including very intimate things that I have received, but sometimes the means might come through different ways. look, we live in this world of experiences. As I've repeatedly said, we experience many laws and forces. If you wish for a house, it ain't going to be like Jack and the Beanstalk, where you throw the beans out the window and the vine or the house grows.
Yeah.
But it could be that your friend Mike says to you, oh, shit, I've just been working a contracting job on this killer house. You have to come take a look at it. It wouldn't be right. Natural. It wouldn't be right to sit in a room and say, no, thanks, Mike. I don't need to look at it because the house is just going to appear. Honor the channels of arrival. Honor the channels of arrival. It might come in a multitude of ways, some of them very ordinary, but the ordinary can lead to extraordinary. There's all these myths through religious tradition in every faith that gods or angels or deities will come disguised as strangers. And the person who invites in the stranger and is hospitable to him will be granted great rewards. How often do we neglect gods and angels who are disguised as strangers because that's too ordinary. That's too ordinary. It can't arrive that way. It can't arrive in a pill. It can't arrive through, you know, some ordinary procedure. Well, of course it can. Of course it can.
Fuck, that's heavy, man. I never... Oh, my God. I feel so dumb. I the other thing Goddard's doing is it, like, the invitation to... He, like, flat out says there wasn't a Jesus. This is a psychological process.
That's right.
There is no historic Christ. We're talking about like that outside of you.
Yes.
Or, you know,
and you know, Neville makes the point. He argues that there's no historiography whatsoever in Scripture. There's not a word in Scripture that's historical. It's all a psychological blueprint. And I have to say, this also is where I serve as a critical student of Neville's, because there are some areas of Scripture, Old and New Testament, that really lend themselves well to a symbolical reading.
Yeah.
But the Book of Chronicles, for example, is just a recitation of generations. It's really very dry reading. And I, again, in the name of self-verification, I have read Scripture. I have spent a long, long time. I had an Orthodox bar mitzvah. I have read Old Testament.
Yeah.
I have read New Testament. And I can assure you, you know, there are passages that do not lend themselves to the same kind of symbolical analysis that others do. And sometimes, may the purist forgive me, sometimes I feel that Neville would cherry pick from Scripture.
I get that sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
That and it's okay because I can like correct for that. But honor the channels of arrival. Does this diverge a little bit from Neville's philosophy? Because he would say things like, once you've done this thing where you become that which you wish to be,
yeah,
the person who lives in that house, or the person who has that the love, or the person who has that form, he doesn't say worry about it. He says, that's it. You're done. You did it.
He does say that. You're absolutely right. He says, you're done. You did it. As soon as you're in the feeling state, the reality is accomplished. But he also says, don't worry about the means of arrival because it will unfold in its own perfectly natural, wonderful way. And I think you can find in Neville's work, if he doesn't say this explicitly, he certainly says it implicitly. We live in the world of Caesar and we have to honor that. You know, I have a friend who is the head of a mid-sized industrial firm in the Midwest. And this is where this Neville stuff is wonderful, because you can become friends with everyone. Conservative dude with a crew cut who drinks beer, smokes cigars. You would think we don't have much in common.
Right.
But we're really intimate friends. And he says to me, listen, nobody I work with knows I'm into this Neville stuff. And I have a board of directors to whom I have to answer. And they want a business plan. I know the business plan because I understand mental creativity. But these dudes need from me pieces of paper. So what should I do? And I said, honor them, man. You know, honor them. You live in a world of Caesar. I live in a world of Caesar. Give those guys what you need, what they need. But you know the engine of creation behind what's going on. Honor Caesar, but you know the engine of creation.
Okay, let me stop you there. This is actually, I'm so glad you're bringing this up.
Yeah.
Because I've heard, and maybe I misunderstood, I think I read Crowley saying, if magic works for you, if you have a successful, if it works, then you have to say out loud, right? Did I misunderstand? Like, you need, and also the denial of Christ is equivalent to this, which is like, if you're using this incredible philosophy,
right,
and it's working for you,
right, right,
that you say that it's the paper,
right,
isn't it a disservice? Isn't it a
Well, he says it to me. You know, he says it to me, and I quote him in my books, albeit anonymously, so that other people can grok to this and learn from it. But I think Neville would probably say, you know, based on the parables of Scripture, Don't cast your pearls before swine. Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. Oh, so if there's somebody who's going to throw rocks at you because they don't dig it, don't talk about it in front of the rock thrower. Just leave the rock thrower to himself. Do your thing, and then tell your friend Mitch, you know, but you don't have to tell your rock thrower, you know? Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, and also it reminds me in the Bhagavad Gita, there's this, it says, don't disturb the minds of people who aren't ready for this.
Let them be.
Let them be.
Let them be. Uspensky, P.D. Uspensky, the great mathematician and mystic, said, life is like a train yard in which there's all these trains going around, and sometimes they're going crazy, and they're going to bump into people, they're going to bump into you. Your job is not to fix broken machines, but your job is to get out of their way.
Wow! Yeah. Get out of the way of the broken machine.
Right, right.
While you're working on your machine.
Yeah.
And so, do you, this is my final question. It's going to seem like I'm being obnoxious and trying to find some crazy simile
not at
question.
All.
To me, another big takeaway from this is that there is the potential for a global utopia, world harmony.
Yeah.
That Shambhala or the mythical cities are already existing coordinates in this multiverse of that Goddard is talking about. And that in a person's life, even better than ascending and not dying, you could theoretically somehow drive your awareness. What did you call it? The it's not manifesting, it's
selecting.
You could select a planet where there is harmony, where we have found a way to heal the planet, where there is there's a way to drive your multiverse ship there. Do you think that's possible?
I would have to agree that it's possible based on the implications of this law. Neville said the lion lying down with the lamb is literal fact, and it will come to be fact in time. But we as individuals are far away from that. We have to learn who we really are. And as we learn who we really are, and as we come to a true sense of our cosmic identity, that world becomes fact. That world becomes fact. It may take the perception of many lifetimes, but that world eventually becomes fact because that's the nature of where we emanate from.
Woo! Mitch, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It is always just and also, by the way, thank you. That thing that's happening to me with this like regimented workout thing, it's directly because of you. It just, you came through Noah Lampert. You know what I mean? Like you echoed through time.
Wonderful.
It's so cool.
And now you have a Peter Frampton t-shirt to wear with your new physique.
Thank you for my shirt.
Well, love Peter Frampton.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, man.
Magician of the Beautiful, an intro to Neville Goddard. It's now out on all the usual places. Is there a place you want to direct people to?
You know, people can find the book any place they buy books. They can find me at my website, mitchhorowitz.com. Throw my name into Google. I'm easy to locate.
Thank you, sir.
Pleasure,
Hare Krishna. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Remember, it's our sweet sponsors that support the DTFH, so give them some love. Check them out. Also, much thanks to you for listening. And don't forget, if you like us, subscribe to us. Give us a nice rating on iTunes and tell your friends to listen. Much thanks to the Boner Alchemists over at BlueChew.com for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. That's blue, like the color blue. Blue Chew brings you the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis, so you know they work. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach, and since they're chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill, so you can be ready whenever an opportunity arises. I would not pitch this sort of thing to you if I hadn't tried it myself and my friends. As a longtime consumer of a variety of pills of this nature, I can assure you it worked for me. And if it worked for me, it'll probably work for anybody. Blue Chew is prescribed online and shipped straight to your door in its discreet package. So no in-person doctor's visit, no waiting in the pharmacy, and best of all, no more awkwardness. But P.S., let me just add to that copy. Why are you awkward about it? If you're not getting boners and super fast, well, of course you're not. The ice caps are melting. Every time you turn on the news, it's Anderson Cooper talking about aliens. It isn't exactly boner weather, friends. Most guys talk a good game, but Blue Chew helps you follow through. Blue Chew is prescribed online, shipped straight. Also, they're made in the USA, and since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they're cheaper than a pharmacy. Right now, we've got a special deal for our listeners. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment free when you use our special promo code Duncan. You just pay $5 shipping. Again, that's B-L-U-E, chew.com, promo code Duncan to try it free. Blue Chew is the better, cheaper, faster choice, and we thank them for sponsoring the podcast.